Stick it in your face, 'cause it comes from the place you're living in. Stick it in your face, 'cause it comes from the place you're living in. Welcome to Food Talk. I'm Marianne Myers, and I am here with my co-host Linda Perkins and our special guest Asa Cody. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I've got my apron on.
I know.
And my apron today is dirty. I mean, my apron, it's not like, oh, I've got a couple spots on it. My apron is grimy and filthy.
It looks like, you look like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Barry Pollock, that's my name.
What's going on with your apron?
Oh man, I've just been putting up jam. It's berry season. It's this year, it's such a delight for me because normally I do a lot of stuff with berries. I pick a lot of berries. But this year, what I decided to do is keep all the varietals separate and make different varieties of blackberry jam. And we were talking a few weeks ago on our show just about how strawberries, you know, they all just taste either more like strawberry or less like strawberry. But blackberries, they all taste different. And I thought, what if I made a bunch of different varietals of blackberry jam? And it is just enlightening. So I brought you a couple
I'm
to
I'm so
taste.
Excited. I wish you could see it because you know blackberry jam is gorgeous. But I have two jars of jam here, one labeled obsidian.
Yeah, try that one. See what you think.
Okay.
So that's the first one.
All right.
And to me, that's just kind of like a blackberry taste in jam. And I am actually shocked at how different the different varietals taste. I mean, I knew that the berries tasted different, but I just didn't know how different they would be. So that's just kind of blackberry jam, right?
Yeah.
So that's the obsidian variety. It's a beautiful berry. I mean, you just want to marry that
it's
berry
lovely.
When you see it. It's gorgeous and handsome.
And it makes me want peanut butter real bad.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? That would be really, really good with peanut butter. But now try that one there.
This is Black Diamond.
Black Diamond. Now that's a thornless blackberry. And so the canneries are loving it because it doesn't have thorns. They are actually trying to get away from marrying berries because they say every year they get sued because of thorns in something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that.
Yeah, where are these berries from?
God.
Yeah.
but they're grown here in Oregon, but they're not native berries. Isn't that delicious? Mm.
Black Diamond.
Yeah, I just
Wowie.
Love it. I think it's just extraordinary. And it's so different from the other, isn't it?
Yes.
I was just shocked.
That would be such good pie.
Yeah, anything. Good anything.
Yeah.
I just love it. Anyway, so I've been putting all that up and I've been cleaning berries and freezing them. And so I am a mess. I have this apron that I got from Becky Tonkin. I mean, maybe 2 weeks ago, and it looks like I've had it a century.
it's a hard-working apron. Oh my gosh. Well, you were telling us before we went on the air that you just got 55 pounds. Is that what you said, 50?
No. Well, I stumbled into 500 pounds.
500 pounds.
Yeah, of fresh blackberries, which has been a lot of work. So it was just, you know how the weather was so hot. I mean, it hit 100 a couple days in Portland already. And then it was so rainy and cold, and it's just been really hard on the berry farmers. So a farmer had just a lot of mushy berries, which is no problem for me making jam. They weren't moldy or anything, just mushy. And so I went up and got those. And that's pretty much, there's like 40 pounds on my apron. But when I pick berries normally, and those are just the invasive ones, the Himalayans and the evergreens, I wear an apron when I'm in the field because, you know, you kind of press yourself against the bushes and you want to keep from getting, you know, perforated. But the apron gets very dirty and it's like this like badge of honor for me. I don't wash it all season long so that it can be like as dirty as it can. And I just feel like I put that thing on and it's stiff like gym socks from a teenage boy. And I feel like I've accomplished so much. So I have a dirty apron story.
You do?
Yes.
We're dying to hear it.
So this is probably almost 3 years ago, but you know, my apron is how it always is in the summer. It's very, very dirty from pricking the berries. And I'm every morning I get up, you know, before it's real hot in the field and I pick the berries. So this field is a field that a farmer lets me pick berries in. He uses berries and ditches for fences. So, you know, there's miles of berries. And, this is when there were still cows in the field. There's bulls now. So it's a lot more interesting, but, there's flies, but they don't come out till the sun is pretty warm, you know. So if you pick in the morning, you're okay. But as I go along my route, it gets warmer and warmer, and the flies come out, and they try to, you know, get in your mouth and get in your eyes, and But every day when I would come around the barn, you know, I'd have like a route I'd follow. I'd come around the barn, and at the back corner of the barn, there was a fly, and it would land on my apron on a very specific berry stain. And so it was in the upper right quadrant, and it would just land there. So I wouldn't bother that fly because it wasn't trying to get in my nose, you know. So, but every day that fly, and I assume it's the same one, of course, that fly would land on that exact same spot, and there were 1,000 spots on my apron, and then about 2/3 across the long side of the barn, then it would fly away. So it would just, you know, come with me, and I thought, I got a fly friend. I mean, how many people have
a friend? It's like a parrot on your shoulder.
I know. How many people have a friend that's an insect? And I'm like, this is so awesome. I've got a fly buddy, you know? And I'm thinking all these, like, great, warm, fuzzy fly thoughts. And then one day, as the summer progressed, I thought, you know, I mean, the idea occurred to me that maybe he was like a fly cowboy, and I was like this unwitting participant in some giant fly rodeo. But anyway, it was just that year I had the fly buddy. I don't know how long they lived.
I don't know how long.
And it could have been
live.
A different fly every day, and I was the rodeo, you know. Look, I rode her too. And that was the saddle, that one berry spot.
Oh, God. Hey, so when are we going to have our wild blackberries? August.
So, yes, but, you know, there's that adage for the local dewberries. Some people call them fence line berries, you know, and they are a true vine. So the invasive ones, the Himalayas and the evergreens, they are, I think they call them bush vines because they're sort of like bushes, sort of like vines, that, and they have the big, long, tough, giant canes that have the square, or maybe they're pentagon. I can't remember if they have four or five sides, edges, you know. So those are the two invasive ones. But the local little tiny native or blackberries that people, that are also called dewberries, there's an adage, you should have a pie by the 4th of July. So they'll be starting pretty soon. There was a patch that I knew about, but it's in a field where the tide gate broke last winter.
Uh-oh.
And so then to get all the big equipment, and it was giant equipment, in to fix the dike and the tide gate, then that patch got taken out. So that was the only place I knew where to pick them. But in any number.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, those are so good, and they're worth looking for.
They are so good.
Yeah, but the rest of them a month later, August, you're right.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
There's already stuff. Yeah. I mean, really, food-wise, this time of year, you don't actually have to look forward to anything because it's all just right here.
Know,
it's so fabulous.
In your lap, your grimy, grimy lap.
We talked, you and I, off air last week, last time we were together here on this show, about what we were like, well, what should we talk about next week? And we thought about talking about sandwiches because it's getting to be picnic time of year. And it's getting to be who wants to cook something that takes forever on a hot stove time of year. Mm-hmm. And you emailed me a link for a recipe for Asian sliders.
Boy, howdy, I like it.
That sounded great.
Yeah. So it does. The thing about sandwiches is I think that they are so underrated. I think that they can be extremely delicious. I think that they work in a lot of situations. But I think if you just take some time to think about how to compose it as opposed to slap it together, that you can make something really wonderful. So this Asian slider recipe is, and it can be a whole sandwich, of course. It's just a recipe where you cook some pork butt with hoisin sauce in a slow cooker till it gets, you know, just in chunks till it gets just really nice and tender. And then there's two other parts. There's a wasabi mayonnaise, which essentially is just mixing wasabi powder with mayonnaise. And then there's a pickled slaw kind of thing that goes on it. And the thing, it has rice vinegar, and it has, you know, that ginger that you put on sushi, that pickled ginger.
Uh-huh.
And that just makes it so delicious. And so, and cucumbers and red peppers, a couple other things. And so just the combination of the three things are really, really good. I also squirt some hoisin sauce on the sandwich too, and that's good. But that's really good. But like compose sandwiches like that where they have more than just like mayo and meat and cheese. I just really like recently, because I work down at Pat's Pantry, and it's a spice store, and I can walk around and smell all the spices. If you smell a spice and you like it, you're most likely going to like how it tastes. And so what I've been doing is, you can call it aioli, but what I do is I just like maybe take some harissa and mix it with mayonnaise, but that makes just a delicious sandwich spread. Or she's got this green curry called vadivan, mix it with
the vadivan is fabulous, and so is Madras curry mixed in mayonnaise. Yeah, I use it all the time. It's one of my favorite steamed asparagus dips. Yipes.
Well, and it's such a complex flavor for such a simple process of take the spoon and stir.
Yeah. And I think that the spreads and the bread are the key to fabulousness.
Yes.
On salads, and I love, oh, by the way, that recipe is on the website at northcoastfoodweb.org. Click on recipes, you'll find the Asian sliders. I love the slaw on there, and for me, the secret ingredient often is either the spread and or slaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on a turkey sandwich or a vegetable sandwich, sort of a sweet, sour, like a creamy dressing slaw with a little apple in it and some crannies. Really good on turkey or roast chicken. And the vinaigrette slaws, like the oriental sort of flavor slaws on roast beef, pastrami, sharp cheese.
Yeah.
Ooh, really good with sharp cheese.
Pat does a thing, Pat Milliman, and she's part of the Food Web, where she takes onions and she caramelizes them, and then she mixes in some fig vinegar.
Ooh.
And that's so good on a pork loin sandwich.
Ooh.
And if there was anything, like if I had magic powers and there was one thing, like one bit of knowledge I could impart on everybody in the world, it would be the ability to cook intuitively, just to wing it and have it turn out good. And I think your nose is such a big thing. Do you like how it smells? But sandwiches, these spreads like you're talking about, you can mix spices in mayonnaise. But also, if there's like a hot sauce, and I'm not talking one of those macho hot sauces, look at, you know, how close to death I am eating this. But just anything that's kind of spicy, you just, you know, mix it with mayonnaise and you have got a sandwich spread. And if you like the flavor of the sauce, you'll like the flavor. It doesn't even have to be hot. If you like hoisin sauce and you mix it with mayonnaise, that would be good.
I also like mixing things with cream cheese, like a mango chutney mixed into a softened cream cheese, or cranberry chutney, any kind of thing like that, as a sandwich spread to just make everything a little more thinly sliced, like a tart apple, like a Granny Smith apple, instead of lettuce.
So you were talking about the bread.
I just think that the bread is key to a really good sandwich.
Yeah.
And especially, I think even, I mean, certainly taste-wise, that's where it's at, a really good, hefty, whole grain bread. But also, if you're packing a lunch,
you want it to stand up.
You totally do not want to have to eat your sandwich with a fork. So I like really dense, brown bread, whole grain bread, but even just a really tight crumb, good white bread will work. Just can't be squishy bread.
Do you have favorites that you can get around town?
Oh, well, yeah. I love the hurricane wheat from Scorcher.
Yeah.
There's a lot of places in our world that make fabulous bread. The Pacific Way Bakery makes killer.
Oh, that oatmeal molasses bread.
Oh, my God.
My God, I don't care. I mean, fill the tank up. I'll drive down there.
Yeah. We have an embarrassment of riches where bakeries are concerned. There's some fabulous stuff coming out of the bakeries in Cannon Beach and Astoria in Gearhart in Seaside. There is no excuse not to eat good bread. None. There's no excuse.
But that's part of the challenge of having a repertoire. Like you want to have like go-to things that you can make that'll be delicious if you're going to have people over, if you just want to make a delicious meal. And I think part of that is knowing, oh, I like that bread. You know, I have that bread in my tool belt. You know, it's not bread that you necessarily have to make, and there's breads that you can make. But in the summer, you probably don't want to do that. And most people don't want to do that ever. But just knowing where to go and get it, that's a big thing. And it's a thing that I think you have to consciously look for. And
if you step outside the supermarket a little bit and look around your neighborhood, you're going to find a bakery. And very often they're going to have more than one kind of bread. And that's the way to go about figuring out what you love. But also sandwiches, pita bread, not any bread. I mean, a sandwich doesn't have to be, it could be a lettuce wrap. A lot of people can't do wheat. So there's gluten-free products, but sandwiches can be open face. This morning I left my husband with egg salad on a bagel.
Good for you.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. There's the new trend, and I think this is kind of funny, but all the bakeries in San Francisco and everything, what they're doing is toast. It's like $4 a slice.
I know.
Yeah. And so
avocado toast.
Yeah, it's become an open face sandwich, like just, you know, one side of it. But yeah, everybody is doing just big, hearty, dense slabs of toast with a bunch of stuff on it, and that's become the breakfast, the hip, trendy bakery thing.
It's just what we're doing these days.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, summer is definitely sandwich season, no matter what it is you prefer in your sandwich. This is a time of year to explore the possibilities, because it really does let us off the hook for any heavy-duty cooking. And we can take it anywhere, to the beach.
Yeah.
So I'm inspired. And I always feel like I'm getting away with something when I fix sandwiches for dinner.
You know what? That's really true. I never thought about it, but it is really true. You want them to taste good, like you're given something special, but then you're like, woohoo, I got away with that.
I know. It's like, here's a nice salad and a sliced apple. Love you. I need to remind everybody, I get to remind everybody that you're listening to Coast Community Radio. This is Food Talk. Linda Perkins and myself, Marianne Myers, are here to talk to you about food. And we're very, very happy to welcome Asa Cody, who is not only going to be a regular presence on the radio very soon, we want to talk about that, but is going to be teaching a cooking class at North Coast Food Web about how to cook for your dog.
Aww. Yes, canine cookery, way to your dog's heart.
So tell us a little bit about what's in store for us at the class and when it's going to be.
June 25th, this Saturday at 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m.
All right.
And many of the people that have called already and are interested have dogs and are in some level of already cooking for their dogs. But I have also had people that have called me, why would you cook for your dog? And my thought is, well, to begin with, we have always cooked for our dogs, whether we cook deliberately for our dogs or we just shared with them what we had. We've been doing this since the cave days, right? This is not a new thing. This is a return to an original relationship. And the pet food industry, after the Second World War, took advantage of industrial canning, which really came out at the Second World War. And it also gave the meat industry a place to put their 4D meat. And so they began to produce ready-made canned dog food. Well, this was very successful, as you can imagine, because it was very convenient. And along with this went the story that this was a better nutrition, it was a more complete nutrition, and you didn't even have to think. Over the course of time, it has become you don't know what to feed your animal. Mm-hmm. We have all the answers, and people food, quote unquote, is not healthy for them. Well, as people grow up and they forget, it suddenly is something that many young people, especially, you pick up a bag of kibble, you get a couple cans, and you're done. They have absolutely no idea that sharing with our animals is not only pack behavior, but it is much more responsible, because you then know exactly what your animal is eating. And part of the problem we have with the pet food industry is dubious sources, outsourced from places like China, where we have no idea of their procedure. We don't know their water quality. We do know that some of the products that they have sold us have made our animals sick and have actually killed animals, and some of those products are still on the market today, because the pet food industry doesn't have the same recall situation. Most of the recalls are voluntary, which means the FDA does not come in and say you have to do this, even though it's killed 60,000 animals. They have to do it if there's a problem.
Yes. So I feel really strongly about this, and I'm so glad that you're teaching that class.
Oh, thank you.
So I feel that we're a capitalist society, and any company, not just pet foods, are driven by profits. And profits are made by making something cheaper. So why would they hire a legion of scientists to figure out everything exactly that a dog needs? I mean, if you're going to feed a dog kibble, and that's what it's going to eat, and you're not going to feed it table food because that teaches it bad habits, then how do you know that everything your dog needs is in there? It probably isn't, because there's no impetus. There's no reason for them to figure out everything that a dog needs.
They spend a huge amount of money on R&D.
Okay.
Absolutely huge. I mean, that's part of their business model. But what we've discovered is that the cheaper brands of dog food, we're talking about the bags of kibble that you can, you know, 50-pound bags that you can get mm-hmm. for $1.75, right? Those are made with the absolute cheapest ingredients. And we're talking not even the 4D meat. And 4D meat, dead, diseased, decayed, or dying.
Oh,
so that's what 4D meat means. Okay. Oh. But if you look at the bag, and I really ask everyone to at least read the labels before you pick up a bag of anything. Because if you find corn as the very first ingredient, discard it. Corn in this country is 90% GMO. Whether or not you agree with the technology and the science of GMO, the fact that it has been created to be able to withstand huge amounts of pesticide. So you have a heavily pesticided product that is undigestible to dogs. And if you gave your dog a corn cob or some loose corn, you'd see it the next day in their poops. They do not digest corn. So turning corn into a powder, for example, is not going to make it any more digestible. It actually makes it a highly concentrated and highly allergic ingredient. And we find several times that animals that have this, it looks like it's passing through okay, but eventually they begin to have health problems that are related to eating way too much grain to begin with, very, very low levels of meat product, and then all of these additives, of which we have no clue what some of them are. Because, for example, when people went from grain, people said, we don't want so much grain. Okay, what do? I know, let's put in legumes. So you see garbanzo beans or cassava root, which I will remind people is a poisonous root and it takes several washings to be able to make tapioca. So when you have cassava root, you're just asking for trouble. These poor animals are eating food that is not natural for them at all. So if the pet food industries, as they say, have complete nutrition, this is the way your dog should eat, no people food, why then, and I would love them to answer this, are our animals coming down with human mm-hmm. diseases, diabetes, thyroid, pancreatitis, Cushing's, gluten problems? They wouldn't be coming down with these things if they were not eating food that's causing it for them.
Do you know what my vet told me? He said that if you cook for your dog, it will live 3 years longer.
Oh, I think it's more than that. My dog was diagnosed with cancer when he was, I think, 12 years old. They had it removed, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said there was nothing we could do, because I certainly couldn't afford to put him on chemotherapy, yeah. even if I wanted to. So I kept him alive, pain-free, and upright. He died at 16 years old. Wow. He was a huge 100-pound lab, so that's pretty old.
Yeah, that's good.
And he walked into the vet the last day. He was blind, unfortunately, and deaf by that point, but he was still ambulatory. And he looked beautiful. So I think that they will live as long as is their natural life mm-hmm. to live. And it's not just cooking for your animal, it's sharing. This is the real impetus of my suggestions to people, is if you don't have time to spend a lot of time to make a big pot of grub every couple of days or every 10 days or whatever for your big dog, learn the foods that you can share with them and do it on a regular basis. From my mouth to your mouth is pack behavior. And a nutritionally satisfied animal is better behaved, more bonded with their person. And since you go from being food provider, which is putting a bowl down and walking away, to food source, which means you might have something in your pocket at any moment, then they're more likely to be responsive to you in a different way. And we have bound over food with animals from the beginning of time.
Do you think that my dogs like me because of my apron?
I think dogs like berries, and I have several pictures of animals that go around and forage for themselves. And, you know, I would like to say one more thing about kibble. A kibble-only diet is extremely harmful for animals because it is like eating a box of crackers without any water at all. So what you have is these animals consuming these, and I love it that they have these plastic bowls with all these little squigglies in it. And they say, well, my dog eats too fast. Well, it's because the kibble is all the same size and you can suck it up like M&Ms. This is a very unnatural, entirely unnatural. They need the different sizes in order to tell what it is. So to give something that is dry and has all the same size is very unnatural to begin with. So then the animal eats this whole thing. It goes over to a bowl of water and it drinks a whole bowl of water because it's thirsty. Well, that stuff swells up in their gut and becomes, oh, I'm satisfied now because I can't get anything more in there. But it's also very hard to get that out. And what you find then is constipation, constant constipation, and sometimes twisted gut from having an overload of this immovable stuff. And so I would say at least add some water to your dog's kibble or broth or a herbal tea if there are some health issues that might be ameliorated by a little bit of herbal tea. That gives the animal a chance to have some fluid as they're eating. And if they, when an animal goes out and eats a critter, they're eating fluid along with all of the other stuff that they get. It's very, very, very important, even with canned foods, to add some broth or water to it to break it up and make it not so concentrated.
So let's remind everybody, if you would like to join Aza in learning wonderful ways to feed your pet at home, the class for cooking for your dog is
June 25th at 11 a.m. at the North Coast Food Web.
That's this Saturday, and you can register for the class. Classes are very small so that everybody gets a chance to really participate. So if you want to, I know that there are a couple spots left. If you want to register, go to northcoastfoodweb.org and sign up to secure your spot. We're looking forward to it, Aza.
Oh, thank you.
And tell us quickly, we have about a minute left, what we have to look forward to radio-wise.
Oh, well, I really thank the Coast Community Radio for giving me the opportunity to talk about my favorite subject. So on July 12th, Animal Gab Radio, Talk with a Tail, will debut. And it's really a celebration of the free farm and family critters that we love, with interviews from specialists. The first interview is from Josh with the Wildlife Center.
Oh, nice.
There are interviews with a class of animal assistants. There'll be information on spay and neuter. Just music, art, literature. Our relationship with animals is so immediate, so profound, so complex, so conflicted, that I really want to look at all of the ways that we can love them, help them, and make some decisions towards the future about the animals that are still here and whether or not they have a right to be free.
And that is going to be on the...
July 12th.
Yes, but every month, right?
Every month,
so
yes.
That's the second Tuesday?
Second Tuesday.
Okay, from
9:30
to 10.
Yes.
All right in this community affairs slot. Linda Perkins, Aza Cody, thank you so much.